Well, good afternoon. We have been spending yesterday and today looking at what I think is a very, very important topic: how we can maximize our growth of vegetables, a little bit of fruit we've talked about, but primarily in vegetables. But I would like to change our attention just a little bit in terms of what should we put into our garden that's going to maximize nutrition. We have the mechanism, we have the methodology, but now let's talk just a little bit about the kinds of fruits and vegetables that we should put into the garden. And, you know, of course, you can put in anything that you want, but I'm looking at it from the point of view of what can we do to really maximize the amount of nutrition that we're getting from our garden. But first of all, I'd like to spend just a little bit of time in talking about some of the basic requirements that I think that are necessary in terms of having good nutrition throughout our lifespan. The first one has to do with consuming a wide variety of foods. And that's one of the advantages that we have in growing our own garden, and that we can eat foods that are low in calories, but yet at the same time are providing us with a great deal of nutrition. The second has to do with our calorie intake. And we need to look at the total amount of calories coming in and the total number of calories that we're using in exercise and activities of daily life. The nice thing about garden vegetables is we don't have added fat, we don't have added sodium, we don't have added all of the things that we get in a processed food. We want to try to stay away from that. The third area has to be physically active every day. I don't know how you can be more physically active than working in a garden. And so I think that's a real advantage. The fourth is to choose fats wisely for good health. And so this really is talking about avoiding of animal fats and certainly fats that are saturated fats. Vegetable fats, I think, are where we really need to look at as far as the very best. And we know that the best fat comes from olive oil and other monounsaturated fats, which are oils at room temperature. Number five, in terms of choosing carbohydrates wisely for good health. So rather than sugar-based desserts, what's better than a fresh fruit or a frozen fruit or a canned fruit that has come from the garden? We don't always have fresh fruits available, and particularly in the northern part of North America, we've got to put food up, either freezing it or canning it, in order to have food available through the winter. Number six. Increase daily intakes of fruits and vegetables and whole grains. I don't know, again, what is better than fresh food from the garden that's going to help us to meet this goal. Whole grains are another important part of our daily intake and the objectives that we should have. We've already talked about preparing foods with a little salt and finally keeping foods safe to eat. Spent some time late last week in terms of giving some information regarding keeping food safe to eat. And the important thing that I think here is that we refrigerate the food, keeping it at 38 degrees or cooler. We could go up to 40 if we need to, but I think 38 is just a little bit safer. Or that when we cook food, it's important that we cook it to at least 165 degrees Fahrenheit for 15 seconds to destroy any pathological bacteria that may be associated with the food that we are eating. So keeping food safe to eat also can extend to church potlucks. So if you are preparing food at home and you take it to a church potluck, it really needs to be kept cold or it needs to be kept hot. As it's kept hot for a long period of time, what happens to the quality? It goes down very, very quickly. The quality of food is going to be the best as it comes from the oven or it comes from the steamer or the way in which you're preparing the food. So we want to minimize that time just as much as possible. Now, I'd like to talk about what I think are some of the advantages from a nutritional point of view of having vegetables from the garden. Vitamin A is probably the limiting vitamin that most Americans are not getting. Does that make sense? Understand what I said? This is the one that we tend not to get enough of. Because vitamin A is sensitive to oxidation by air. So it's this oxygen activity that is in action here. And so loss of vitamin A activity is accelerated by heat and exposure to light. And so oxidation of the fats and oil, such as butter or margarine, cooking oils, can destroy the soluble fatty acids that are in the oil, which is carrying the vitamin A, as vitamin A is a fat-soluble vitamin. So the presence of antioxidants, such as vitamin E, contributes to protection of vitamin A. But what are some of the important sources of vitamin A? Well, vitamin A is really not that available to us in terms of our normal food consumption. It comes as beta-carotene. And so that beta-carotene is changed in our body to vitamin A. And so the best sources of beta-carotene are yellow and orange vegetables and fruits, vegetables and fruits, and dark green leafy vegetables. Now, what color do we normally associate with beta-carotene or vitamin A? Yellow, orange, carrots, that type of thing. Yes. Now, why are dark green leafy vegetables a good source of beta-carotene when beta-carotene is more orange?
The green covers up the orange.
Precisely. Yep, you got it.
Covers up the orange.
Yeah. The beta-carotene content of fruits and vegetables can vary according to the season and to the degree of ripening. And so vegetables that are grown in Florida compared to vegetables that are grown in California versus Montana or wherever, we're going to see some changes. And so when we look at nutrient analysis in a table or on a computer, the data that we're seeing there is averages from all over the country and is not guaranteed that your carrots have exactly that amount of nutrients. It's an average. And so there are many different kinds of carrots that are available. And I was looking through the seed catalog this morning, and my mouth was just drooling with all the good things. You know, there's, spring is coming, and so it's going to be time to delve into the seed catalogs and make our choices of the kinds of vegetables that we want to have.
They call it seed corn.
Good. But the thing that I think that we need to understand is that carotenoids can lose some of their activity in foods during storage due to the action of enzymes that are in the carrot, for example, or exposure to light and to oxygen. Dehydration of vegetables and fruits also reduce the biological activity of carotenoids. And on the other hand, carotenoid stability is retained in frozen foods. So, which is more nutritious? A carrot, let's say, that has been harvested, it has been processed by cleaning and cutting off the top and so on, and it has been distributed to the various supermarkets over, let's say, a week, or a frozen carrot?
According to this, a frozen carrot, I'm thinking.
Yes, the frozen carrot, because they are processed and brought down to a below freezing temperature of zero or below and maintained at that, that helps to maintain beta carotene. So that, I think, is an important rule that we should keep in mind. But what is the nutrient content of that carrot when it has just been picked from the garden and you have it for supper tonight? That's where it's going to be the very highest. And that's the advantage.
What about if it's stored in a root cellar? It can dark and with some of its original dirt on it.
So what is that avoiding?
Light.
It's light. The light,
and
yes.
Bins, so
yes. So that's what we've got to do then in order to maintain the nutrient content is to store it in dark, cool places to minimize the amount of oxidation that is occurring there. I don't think that we learned anything from that slide. I'm sorry. Now let's take a look at vitamin C. Vitamin C is important in terms of making certain that we have appropriate nutrition. Ascorbic acid is one of the most important vitamins that we have. We automatically think of citrus when we think of vitamin C, but many of the vegetables that we have and fruits as well are good sources of vitamin C. And so if we are concerned about iron absorption, we also need to have accompanying that vitamin C to help in the absorption of the iron during digestion. Oxygen is the most destructive ingredient in juice, causing degradation of vitamin C. And so whether we're talking about orange juice or whether we're talking about any other source of vitamin C, oxygen is going to be a concern. So one of the major sugars that are found in orange juice or any other product that has fructose is going to cause degradation of vitamin C. So the higher the fructose content, the greater the loss of vitamin C. So one of the ways in which we can avoid that, again, is fresh berries and vegetables from our garden. You know, I haven't been successful in growing citrus in the northern part of the state. I grew up in Washington State, and I'm about ready to move to Oregon. I'm thinking that, you know, I would like to take some citrus along with me because I have a backyard that is full of citrus trees that I really, really enjoy. The third vitamin that we need to talk about is vitamin D. What fruit or vegetable is a good source of vitamin D? Almost none of them. They're very, very poor sources. But where do you get your vitamin D? You get your vitamin D by working out in the garden with the sunlight. So that's an important point, I think, that we need to look at. So be outside every day. Vitamin E is another. Vegetable oils like olive oil, soy oil, palm oil, corn oil, and so on, help to maintain their antioxidants. It is an antioxidant to keep the oils from oxidizing and becoming rancid. And so as a result of that, we really need to include the whole grains, as we were looking at the beginning, as very good sources of vitamin E. And so I doubt that very many of us, except our friend here, is going to be growing much grain. But at the same time, we need to include in our diet on a daily basis, good sources of vitamin E. Now, vitamin K is an important vitamin as well. And it, too, is found in green leafy vegetables such as spinach and broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, and lettuce. And so I think that you're familiar with the fact that vitamin K is important in the clotting of blood. And vitamin K is relatively stable in heat, but sensitive to acid or alkaline. So it's going to want a pH very close to 7. And it's also sensitive to light and to oxygen. Now, thiamine. Thiamine is found in most foods, but mostly in relatively small amounts. The best source of thiamine is in brewer's yeast, but it we also would get it in whole grain cereals and bread, nuts, vegetables, dried legumes, and potatoes. What happens in the milling of grain? That outer coating of the wheat kernel, the bran, is removed, and that is where much of the thiamine is found. And so if we are using a white flour that has not been enriched, we are losing all of the thiamine that is in there. However, because of enrichment, some of it is replaced. But it's like taking a dollar from someone and giving them 30 cents in change and saying, you've got enough thiamine. But you have lost a lot of it by using a refined grain. So the same is true in brown rice. In removing the rice hulls, that thiamine is eliminated. Do you know the name of the disease that's caused by deficiency of thiamine? Beriberi. My mother grew up in southern Louisiana, and when she was young, she had a form of beriberi because her father was a rice farmer, and the only rice that they ate was milled rice, rice that had been had the hull removed. And so a major portion of the thiamine that she needed didn't get. And so this was, you know, during the Depression when there was not a lot of food available. Thiamine is unstable when exposed to heat, to alkaline pH, to oxygen, and to radiation. And so water solubility is also a factor in the loss of thiamine as food is being cooked. So about 25% of the thiamine in food is lost during normal cooking process. So we could take a vegetable that is high in thiamine and pick it from the garden and take it into the house and cook it, and we would get about a 75% yield of the thiamine. So does that make that food a thiamine-deficient food? It doesn't have as much to begin as it had to begin with. But the amount of thiamine that we need from a wide variety of foods is still going to give us enough if we do follow good basic nutrition. So to preserve thiamine, food should be cooked in a covered pan for the shortest time possible and should not be soaked in water or heated for too long. And so the leaching that would occur during the soaking in the water would be something that would decrease the thiamine level, something that we should probably stay away from. But the other thing that we should do is to reuse some of these, much of this liquid in stews and sauces, use it for making gravies and this type of thing to help to keep as much of that thiamine available to us as possible. Riboflavin. Milk is probably the source of the most riboflavin that we get. milk and milk products, but it's also available in green leafy vegetables. But one thing that I would like to suggest, that if you are using what I refer to as a dairy equivalent, soy milk, almond milk, any of those kinds of things, I really hate to call them a milk because it's not exactly the same, but it would be a dairy equivalent. Make certain that it has the amount of calcium that we would expect to see in cow's milk. Make certain that it has B12, and make certain that it has a good source of riboflavin as well. Cereal grains, yes?
Would that mean that rice milk or the soy milk would have to be enriched with that? It doesn't come in there normally.
It doesn't come in normally. So you've got, it's a very, very highly processed product.
It is.
And so you've got to make certain that you are getting the calcium and particularly the B12 and riboflavin that you need.
Well, that would come in green leafy vegetables.
That's exactly right, and that's what we're going to get in our garden.
Yep.
Good. Thank you. And so, as a result of the fortification process, when flour is milled, they replace some of the nutrients with riboflavin as one of the others that is in cereal grains. But again, it's not as much as what was originally in the grain to begin with. You're getting shortchanged is what's really happening. So make certain that you are maintaining a good source of riboflavin and that you are keeping that in your diet. And because the riboflavin is degraded by light, we can experience up to a 50% reduction in foods that are just left out in the sunlight or any ultraviolet light. But riboflavin is stable when heated, so it's not easily destroyed in the ordinary process of cooking, but again, will leach out in the cooking process and in the water. And pasteurization, because of the high temperature, is losing about 20% of the riboflavin content. One of the things that I think is very important is that we don't think in terms of black and white, that if we have a nutrient in a food and we cook it, particularly those that are sensitive to heat, that's not going to take all of the nutrients away, particularly like in riboflavin when we had a 80% yield. So we see a reduction, but we don't see a complete elimination of that nutrient unless you are really, really careless in the way in which you're handling that food and you leave it out, exposing it to heat and to sunlight for an extended period of time. Ellen White talks about the fact that we should not use baking soda as a product. My grandmother was born in South Carolina and grew up in Louisiana. And I would often see her adding baking soda to greens. You know why she did that?
Keep them green.
Keep them greener, that's right. So to keep them from leaching out. When I would visit my grandmother, we would get up from the breakfast table at 7:30 or 8 o'clock in the morning, and she would go to the stove and put on the green beans, and they would cook all morning long. Because they were indeed string beans. Do you know what I mean when I talk about string beans?
Mm-hmm. The thing that's left is a string.
That's right. So that string has, in some of the varieties of green beans, has been removed. And so we don't tend to call them string beans anymore, but in that day, they were definitely string beans and almost inedible. But that addition of the baking soda would destroy the riboflavin that was in there. So that is something that I think that we need to look at. Scott?
When you get aluminum-free baking soda, does that help any?
It's the sodium bicarbonate that's the primary thing. This is baking soda, and so not baking powder. Is that what you're... Yeah.
And so baking powder doesn't do that?
Baking powder contains soda.
Oh, so it does.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Does aluminum-free take care of that?
No. Sorry. Baking soda is sodium bicarbonate, and baking powder has some other salts in there that create carbon dioxide when they are either heated or come in contact with water. They all have to come in contact with water to act. But some of them are single acting and some of them are double acting. And so the double acting initially begin when they're hydrated, and then the second portion, they react when they're heated. And so you get a more a rise when the product is put into the oven. Okay, vitamin B6 is pyridoxine. Pyridoxine is relatively stable to heat. It is decomposed by oxidation and ultraviolet light, and again by an alkaline environment. So, again, this is one of the nutrients that we've got to be careful about in terms of the way in which we cook our food. Freezing of vegetables causes a reduction of up to 25%, while milling of cereals leads to a waste as high as 90% in terms of pyridoxine. So cooking losses of processed foods may range from a few percent to nearly half of the nutrients that were originally present in the food. So that's primarily related to pyridoxine. So are you beginning to feel that, you know, there's no nutrition left in these foods? I want you to know that there is still nutrition that is left in there, and that we should not eliminate these foods from our diet because there's no nutrition in it, but there is indeed, and we must use that as our source of nutrition.
So that what was removed in milling, if you grind it up whole grains fresh, does that remove it too, or is that?
No, that's fine. That is just fine. It's when the grains are milled and the bran and the wheat germ are removed and not replaced. That's the critical element there. Yep. Now, vitamin B12. Vitamin B12 is one of the issues that is particularly of concern to vegetarians. I don't think there's any surprise at that. But there is nothing that we can grow in our garden that is going to give us vitamin B12. Do you know where vitamin B12 comes from? It is
bacteria.
Grown as a part of the metabolism of bacteria. That's exactly right. And that's where it comes from. And so we talk about getting B12 from animal products. Well, it's there because of contamination. And I don't think that we want to eat contaminated foods, but we still need to have a source of vitamin B12. Now, vitamin B12 is stable to heat, but slowly loses activity when it's exposed to light, oxygen, and to a pH less than or greater than 7. So it's important that we have a reliable source of vitamin B12. There are other sources that are talked about, but I think the most important thing is that we have reliability so that it is consistently in our diet. A supplement.
Well, what type of supplement? I mean, are some of the supplements made from good products or bad products?
Supplements that are coming from bacterial growth and metabolism. And the thing that I would encourage you to do is to buy the least expensive one possible. You don't need to buy an expensive one because they all have the same action. Yes? I'm sorry? Yeah, nutritional yeast flakes is another source. And that, too, is coming from bacterial action. There's no difference. Thank you for reminding me about that. The amount of vitamin B12 that you need on a daily basis is 6 micrograms.
But the nutritional yeast has to be fortified with B12.
Yes. Make certain that it does contain B12. Yeah. And it's got to be kept dark and it's got to be kept cool, because it is sensitive then to light. Very good. Thank you.
Yes. If I pull out that carrot and just kind of wipe it off and chew it down the garden, do I get a little bacteria like the cow or the... we get a little bit better?
I think the problem is that we haven't had enough time for that bacterial metabolism to occur from the time that you have picked it until you eat it. There may be just a little bit of tiny about of that, but the word reliable is not there. Yes?
I get my B12 by taking a teaspoon of that good soil I talked about.
Yes?
Putting it in a gallon of water. And I drink that and my B12 is always up.
So you have your serum B12 tested?
I have tested it.
Good, good. Did you send?
I was at a long time ago, back in my early MSA, I went to Agatha Thrash conference, and she said, I think it was her, if you take water in the morning and swish it around your mouth and swallow it, you get the bacteria on your, that bacterial slime on your teeth.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The problem with that is reliability. Again, it may work for one person, but it doesn't work for another person. And so, in order to be safe, I think that we need to look at sources of vitamin B12. Okay, I think that that is a very, very important thing that we've talked about.
No.
I'm sorry, eggs? Good source, yes.
Once a week?
Once a week is quite enough, yes.
Mm-hmm. One egg once a week.
Okay, niacin. We're almost done with this part. Nicotinamide and nicotinic acid are forms of niacin, the vitamin niacin, and they're widely available in nature. Nicotinic acid is more prevalent in plants, where in animals it's nicotinamide. Nuts and legumes contain most of the niacin that's obtained from vegetables and vegetable sources. But milk and green leafy vegetables contribute lesser amounts. So that's where the beans that we're going to plant, or the dry beans that we're going to have, those are going to be the best sources of niacin for us. So in cereal products like corn and wheat, nicotinic acid is bound to certain components of the cereal, and thus it's not available. But I think it's interesting that in the traditional preparations of tortillas in Mexico and Central America, they increase the viability of nicotinic acids by processing it in lime water. And so that lime water makes the niacin available so that it is present in the food that they eat. So this is corn and lime. What other foods do we have, particularly in the South, that are processed in a very similar way? I'm sorry? No. Corn is the base. Hominy. Yes. So it's processed in lime. So it grows and then... No, I'm talking about lime, calcium carbonate. It's a powder. Yeah, you put in water and then it's...
The mineral.
Yeah, the mineral. Mm-hmm. Thank you. So both forms of niacin are stable when exposed to heat, light, air, and alkali. And so there's little loss that occurs in cooking and in storage. So this is one of the nutrients that we really don't need to worry about in terms of loss in the cooking and storage of food. Folic acid. Most forms of folate in food are unstable. Fresh leafy vegetables stored at room temperature may lose up to 70% of their folate activity within 3 days. So this is the one that's going to be most sensitive. Have you ever had a green leafy salad that you've gone out to the garden and picked the leaves and put it into the salad at that point? Is there anything better than that? I don't think so either. I think that is the very best. Yes?
When I sell it, people come back to me sometimes and say, this lettuce was bitter. And I said, well, lettuce really means bitter in Latin.
Yeah.
And so and fresh lettuce has that sort of milky bitterness to it, which you think something's wrong with it if you're not used to it, because once it stays in the store after a few days, you lose that. And you don't get that milky bitterness you do with fresh lettuce, and people think something's wrong with it. You try to explain to them, no, that's, you're something wrong with the stuff you're buying at the store, because they're really used to bland lettuce. And what is that bitterness? Is that some sort of tannic acid?
It's not a tannic acid, but it's part of the nutrients. I mean, part of the Brix that you've been talking about, that is there, that is a reflection of the nutrients that are there, because otherwise what's happening is that they're being lost.
Yeah.
No.
I think so.
Yeah.
The one in the store doesn't have it. So. Mm-hmm.
Julio said that if a green is bitter, it's good for your liver.
Oh, yeah.
That's what he told us.
That's a good idea. Yeah. Very good. Okay. I'd like to transition into another brief topic, and that is based upon the standards that we really should be following in terms of daily dietary intake, and what happens as far as nutrition and processing and storage and transportation of food. What foods should we include in our garden that are going to maximize nutrition? That is number one. Green leafy vegetables. Right there. Green leafy vegetables is number one. Kale, chard, collard greens, spinach, parsley, and all of the dark green and red leaf lettuce are very high in carotenoids and are best eaten raw in salads, sandwiches, or lightly steamed in nutritious soups or stews. For those of you that were in the vegetarian instructor's course all of last week, we had collard greens in a salad. Have you ever had fresh collard greens in a salad?
Yeah.
It's a very good source of calcium, and we need to look at ways in which we can increase the amount of these green leafy vegetables that we're eating on a daily basis. Raw, yes. Yeah,
So,
very, very good. You know, I'm not a big one for collard greens. They don't, not too many people in California eat collard greens like they do in the South. But we really do need, there you go, yeah. Well, that's a good time to have them. Yeah. So let's look at some of the other foods that we should include. Broccoli. What is the growing season for broccoli in Georgia?
It's cool season. You can grow it in the spring. It won't grow in the heat of the summer, or you can grow it back in the fall. It's a lot easier to grow in the fall because in the spring it's getting warmer and warmer and warmer, and it wants to open up and bolt on you.
Yeah, right.
You want to pick them when they're tight-headed and they don't open up. That's when they're the best quality at their peak.
Yeah,
and that's easier to achieve in the fall as it's getting colder.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can grow good spring broccoli, you're pretty good for them.
Good. So that would be one of the things that we'd want to consider growing in the garden. The other one, how many of you like Brussels sprouts? Good. Raw or fresh? Freshly steamed? One of the complaints that people tend to have about Brussels sprouts is that the taste that they get, because as they are cooked a longer and longer time, they develop a taste that is undesirable. And so just a light steaming is all that's really necessary. That taste comes from the buildup of sulfur and the release of sulfur in the Brussels sprouts. The other one is cauliflower, thank you. And It seems to me that more and more people are eating cauliflower than what they used to when I was younger, which is...
Yeah, there's a guy, I don't grow it, but there's a guy at market who loves growing it, and he's developed a, you know, everybody wants cauliflower, goes to him, because he's he grows a purple cauliflower.
Yeah.
And cheddar cauliflower, a sort of an orangish yellow.
Yeah, right.
And a green one.
A green one. Mm-hmm.
And it's just pretty and amazing.
Yeah. I was looking in the seed catalog again, as I said, and saw all of those cauliflower colors out there.
It looks really good at market.
It really, really does. And, you know, one of the problems with cauliflowers is that blah white. But by looking at some of the other colors, that's a one way in which to improve the color of the food on the plate. And it's going to get people more interested in eating those foods. Red and green peppers. Those are some other plants that are very easy to grow and high in nutrition. Are you saying they're not easy to grow? Not easy to grow?
That's why they're so expensive, especially the more nutritious ones, the colorful ones.
Yes.
They take forever. Mm-hmm. And the bugs usually get them by the time they do.
That's the problem.
You maybe oh. harvest. If you're good, you can harvest 50% of them. The other 50% get wasted. They're so expensive in the store. And you'll get them green, and then it'll take 4 to 6 weeks for them to turn color.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It takes a long time.
So your growing season is quite, I mean, you're...
It's a summer crop.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. I can wait, but by the time you wait till it turns colors, you know, the sun scalds it or some insect crawls inside of it and mm-hmm. starts eating it. I mean, you know, it's just tough.
So plant green peppers.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It adds color and good nutrition. Yes.
May I mention, we also learned that you cannot eat raw green peppers.
Yeah.
They're not good for you. I think they're toxic. They have, I'm trying to remember that. I've got it in my notes, but there's a sense.
Did the chef say that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I've never heard that before. I don't know. I. Yeah, yeah.
No.
That could be, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's a debate.
That's true, yeah. Okay. Garlic and onions are another good, nutritious food to include in your garden. And then my favorite, sweet potatoes.
They're easy.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. Because what I'm going to do when I go home in the spring is that I am going to plant as many of these as I can. Because I'm looking forward to being able to apply what I have learned today, yes, and yesterday.
Sand Hill Preservation. It's a guy up in Iowa, and he's got 200 different varieties of sweet potatoes that you got to order a year in advance because he does Sand Hill Preservation.
Hmm.
And his specialty is sweet potatoes, and he's got more varieties than anybody. If you get on his website, you get his catalog, you'll be amazed at all the different sweet potatoes there are. And like I said, you got to order them a year ahead of time. There's a waiting list, and he only sends you 6 starts. Something like that. It doesn't give you very many.
But that's all you need, though, isn't it? For
yeah, you can harvest those and grow, you know, save a couple and grow some more.
Yep, exactly.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Tomatoes. I don't think we need to say anything about tomatoes. Those are very nutritious, high in vitamin C, and there's nothing better than a fresh tomato out of the garden. Absolutely.
It keeps the small farmers afloat.
Yeah, that's where I am, too. Peas, either raw or steamed or stir-fried or however you want to fix them, are good sources of good nutrition. Carrots, that's what I was salivating the most as I was looking through the seed catalog. And so vegetable crops are often we can double the amount that we are growing by doing an early crop and a late crop, depending upon your growing season. So what is probably best in Georgia may be different than what we experience in California, and certainly different than what we'll experience in Oregon. So I learned from you, Scott, that maybe just one planting is all that we want to do, but have an early variety and a late variety in a different bed or
yeah,
different row.
Beds, you know, yeah. And then you can do a third of it, one variety that's early and another third that's late. That really works for you better in the fall than it does in the spring, because in the spring you'll plant something early, but because it's still cool, it'll just sit there. Yeah. 2 weeks later, you'll plant something else, and it'll start growing because it's warmer, and then this one will start growing, and they usually just start...
They come out the same.
Because of the coolness. But it works better in the fall, going from heat to cold, than it does in the spring.
Now, other foods that we often would like to put into our garden, such as corn, large squash, and watermelon, really take a lot of space. And so if you have limited space, there's nothing wrong with these foods, but they take up more space. And so the nutrition that you get per square foot is going to be reduced compared to what you would get with lettuce and some of the other root vegetables that we were talking about. And from my point of view, I would like to see the most nutritious foods that I can grow and get the most yield that I can get possible, so that it's going to do me and my family and my friends the very best as far as nutrition is concerned. And so, you know, what can we do to maximize the yield? And I think that's what we have learned those last 2 days, and I think that is very, very critical for us. So I'm going to give you an assignment. And that assignment is go home and plan. How are you going to grow your garden this coming year? What do you want to eat? How much of each product do you want to have? And grow at least that much in your garden. And the problem that I have is self-control. If a little bit in a garden is going to be good, I want more. But what am I going to do with all of that food that all comes at about the same time? It can be shared. It can go to the church for sharing with the poor and the hungry. Because when we are planting and then harvesting 2 months later, we're going to get peak production, and that's when that food typically is the lowest price in the supermarkets. So if there's ways that we can monitor or modify, is really what I wanted to say, and so that we get food produced at times when it's not peak time for the rest of the area, we may make the best advantage of that, particularly if we're going to sell. Are there any questions that you have? I wish you the very best in your nutrition and in your growing of the garden.
This media was produced by Audioverse for the NAD Health Summit. If you would like to learn more about the NAD Health Summit, please visit www.nadhealthsummit.com. Or if you would like to listen to more free online sermons, please visit www.audioverse.com. Audioverse.org.